Every 2 weeks, we stop talking about food. Just for a few minutes, we stop stuffing our faces with lobster crunch wraps and start talking about music. We become another podcast called All Holes Filled, a transformation, where I pick two records and Mike picks two records that are forgotten, that we forgot to listen to, that we should have listened to because we're metal guys or because we're rap guys or because we're just cool guys.
Yep.
Cool guys should have heard every record by now. A lot of cool guys have heard every record. I talked to so many cool guys, they've heard every record, and I haven't. So we're trying to fix that. So, you know, there's a general, which could be anything. It could be anything, you know, it could be anything from some sort of Beatles record or something to, you know, something. It could be Vane, the new Vane.
Yep.
Although we've both heard the new Vane, so it's not going to be the new Vane. And then, you know, we pick something that's specific to our interests or that is like a thing we actually want to hear, like a passion project to get into. And then we you know, we fill the hole. We listen to the album. We dissect it. We use our expertise and our wide range of interests to absorb a new influence and become better people. All holes filled. This week, I found a pattern this week that we'll talk about. We'll see if maybe you share my opinion. But we started with Australia's Rose Tattoo, the Rose Tattoo album by Rose Tattoo.
Yes. Yeah. This was my choice. This is Rose Tattoo from 1978, the self-titled album Rose Tattoo. So there's a couple of reasons I chose this. The first is I had no idea what this was a band until like a few years ago. It's probably not even been a few years, but basically possible listener of the show, Joe Hawk, who was a listener of Kissing Contest. We follow each other on Instagram and mm-hmm. I see him like talking about this band every now and then, and I think he said it's his favorite band. And Joe's like in an oi band, or he listens to oi music or something like that. So I'm like, it's probably sketchy band. It's probably not. You know, it's probably not what I want to hear. And then I think somehow I was tipped off that it wasn't like an oi band, that it was like some kind of fucking, you know, down home rock and roll.
Right.
And that interested me because it seems, you know, Joe's not the only one. There are, it's for whatever reason, a good amount of punkish people like this Rose Tattoo band. And that's weird. I don't know why, because from the little I knew about them, they just sounded like they were another, like an AC/DC band, and old and Australian. So that's what kind of tipped me off about this record. But this was also chosen because this is kind of a litmus test, because even though we have that big intro in the beginning where we talk about listening to all these old records we missed, there's probably a lot of stuff we're never going to listen to on purpose on the show, just because I guess we could call it like the Neutral Milk Hotel rule, where
yeah.
I listened to that once. I don't remember anything about it. I don't want to talk about it on a podcast. I think that's really boring. Like, there's only so much you could say, like, oh, this is boring white person music
right.
for, you know, people who just, that's, you know, that's their thing. It's just being boring, I guess. And that's not interesting.
I'm not looking for trouble. I'm really not looking for trouble. I'm not looking for a problem.
Yeah. And so, you know, I've never heard the Three Tenors, and that was like a notable album. I'm not going to listen to the Three Tenors on this podcast.
There's a metal one called the Three Tremors. It's got I forget who, I think it's Tim Ripper Owens and a couple other forgotten secondary guys.
Maybe I'll listen to that one. So, yeah. So the classic and like Americana rock and all that type of just like rock and roll, I just hate it all. So this was kind of like a litmus test, because I should talk about Thin Lizzy on the show. I don't know. Is it interesting? And since this has like some kind of punk crossover to it, I figured if I was going to listen to one rock and roll band that's not like the Rolling Stones, who I have heard, so that doesn't count. But, you know, I'll try this Rose Tattoo band that actual punk people like, and see if it's interesting to talk about and if it's worth exploring more in this kind of classic rock genre. And I would say, you know, it was kind of mixed bag. I didn't hate this. It's still, you know, incredibly not my shit. I don't really like rock. I don't like rock and roll. I just, there's really nothing there for me, but there's a lot to find interesting about this. I thought for one, this guy's lyrics are pretty good for rock and roll. Like, he's like very descriptive. There's a lot of songs that it sounds like just cheese dick shit. So I think maybe there might have been a couple people writing these songs, but there are some tracks on here where I'm just like, wow, that is like a kind of advanced for rock and roll lyrics, considering there's basically three subjects on this whole entire record, which is rock and roll, going to prison, or boys, just boys doing things. And that the prison thing is really interesting, because I'm just like, well, they're from Australia, and I think that's like their gimmick in Australia is like everybody's
it's been just, in prison. It is a prison. The whole,
So it's just like, in 1978 Australia really call for having more than one song about prison on your album? It's just like a really weird choice to me to release like a 10 or 12 track album and have like four songs about prison. It's just, it's pretty crazy. I said there's good lyrics. Their song TV is like, you know, it's about television. It's deep, man, but it's like told by the way if like TV was a woman. Trust me, that sounds like real high school bullshit, but it's like, you know, he's really good at shit like that. But at the same time, that there's a song called Stuck on You that has super pedo lyrics to it.
Yeah.
Where he says, a little schoolgirl, come home with me. We'll drink some Coca-Cola and watch my color TV. And that's pretty sketchy. But again, this dude's in and out of prison three times on this record. So maybe we know why
he's paid his dues. He's done his time.
Yeah,
everything's okay.
Speaking of which, there's another line on a different song where he says, "You know, I'll never fear the straight life," he says something like, "I'll never fear being straight" or something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, never gonna suffer a straight man's fears, and that has a completely that has a completely different definition in these modern times. But I think he's talking about prison. I don't know. I will say the song "Nice Boys." Again, this is about boys. That is a jam. Like if we were to make an all time compilation of all time classic all holes filled hits, I would suggest "Nice Boys." So that's my favorite song on here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, outside of that, it's for being basically songs about rock and roll, which is in the genre of rock and roll, is half your songs have to be about rock and roll, and that's just never appealed to me. But for that kind of music, like I tolerated it. I'm probably never going to go back to it, but you know, like I said, I think Nice Boys is an all-time slammer jammer. I don't need to listen to nine more songs about boys being rowdy and going to prison. But I didn't.
Okay, so we won't do Thin Lizzy then, I guess.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, that's what I was thinking the whole time. I was like, well, Thin Lizzy, their big hit's Jailbreak. Mm-hmm. Is this just a thing in this music? Is just people going to prison all the time? I don't know. It could be. That's what I've been missing out on all these years, is people going to prison. Overall, I didn't hate it. I don't think I might, you know, I might, maybe I will do Thin Lizzy. Maybe in like a couple episodes I can revisit this, but. When I was 16, I would definitely completely hate this. I honestly think at this age right now is the only age that maybe is why I could appreciate it, because now I'm at that age. Like in case you don't know me, I don't have like a real old person life. I still live like a fucking child basically. So I'm not like, I don't have kids. I'm not like out mowing the lawn, but now that I'm that old, I could like appreciate that perspective where I'm just like, oh, when you're like life is over and you like you don't have anything to do, I can understand being into this music, because like I don't know how old these guys were at the time, but they probably weren't old, but this is like automatic like in your 40s music. Like I can't imagine listening to this in your 20s. I'm sure people did in 1978, but in the 21st century, I can't imagine being like 24 and being like, yeah, this is my shit, because this just sounds like old mowing the lawn drinking beer music. But you know, in that aspect, I think it's pretty good. But Scott, were you familiar with this band? What do you think of them?
Yeah, I was. But first, I want to back you up, because there's there's a scene up here that I have. They're like a Loch Ness monster. I can't find like real proof that they exist. But there's a whole scene of aging cock rockers in this region, like really like leathery tan, like 70-year-old looking people who still wear like tight like neon zebra stripe leggings and like crazy, you know, crazy fringe jackets, and they go out to rock nights together and they form bands, and you'll see all these pictures on Facebook of all these people in the same place at the same time. I'm like, where is they don't tag anything, so I don't know where they are, but they're out there, and you know, there's a few young people doing it and stuff like that, but it's like, it's definitely like just these older people. They're almost like parrot heads, like Jimmy Buffett fans, where they're just like, they're old and partying so hard That it's keeping them alive. Like the steady infusion of booze is keeping them walking.
So maybe I really should, now that I live like a child, it's going to end someday. It could end tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Maybe I should just start transitioning to this so I can still kind of be like a child without, being not age appropriate, basically.
I imagine these people have a lot of real, real problems, real world, like real adult problems that are just waiting outside in the parking lot for them. At all times. But yeah, I was familiar with Rose Tattoo mostly because, here's a fun tidbit, I told you about this. The singer, Angry Anderson, great name. He's like a sort of stocky bald man. People would know him as Iron Bar Bassy from Mad Max 3 Beyond Thunderdome. He's sort of like anti-entity Tina Turner's like henchman, who wears just sort of a leather girdle and has some sort of like a no mask or like a kabuki mask or something floating above his head. And he has the cool line, "Master Blaster, listen to the law." So if you remember that part of the movie, that's him. That's awesome. Like, I found out about that he was in a band and I had to know more about it. But it was I found out about that in the time when I would have had to buy a CD. So I'm not going to go that far. But, the name's Rose Tattoo, so I kind of had an idea. That's a name that tells you a lot. And, I heard them back then, and it's blues rock. It's like, it's not really it's like bluesy, hard rock, well, biker
Mad
rock.
Mad Max 3 was in the 80s. You mean back then, or like 10 years
ago? No, like later, like way later on, I found out he was in a band, like in college or in my 20s or something like that. I found out that he was in a band. I was like, man, that's neat. So, stuff like that you want to know. I had the internet at the time. I don't remember when it was, but I definitely had the internet. I got the idea that they were like going to be, this kind of outlaw biker something rock. They're better than I would have thought, for sure. And they're interestingly like this. So I'm going to develop a narrative through this episode. Around track 3 or 4, the band sort of changes. So in the beginning, the first 3 or 4 tracks, they sound exactly halfway between Aerosmith and AC/DC. Like, they're a little simple, like AC/DC, and the singer actually sounds like he's perfectly halfway between Bon Scott and old Steven Tyler, like when he was young. And it's better than either of those two bands to me, because I don't like Aerosmith or AC/DC. So if you squish them together, you get something that I don't mind. And then around track 3, it gets a little bit, like he gets better at it or something, and he becomes some other singer that I can't place, like, I don't know, like David Coverdale or something like that. He just becomes somebody else that's a little bit better than either of those two guys. And I'm like, man, he's like he's learning how to sing on this album, which I've noticed in other things that we've done All Holes Filled in the past, where like these seminal albums are like a document of a band learning how to play or something like that. Because I've like track 3 or 4, it's standard. Track 3 or 4, all of a sudden the band gets better or improves technically or something like that. And it happened on several albums for this episode. So, this is not my stuff. I think he's a great singer. I think he's got a really cool voice. I wish it was not over just really playing down. And not only that, there is multiple of those like bad to the bone story songs. Don't. Oh, here comes old Jimmy. He's coming to the bar. I'm going to call. I can't take that. There's no room in my heart, not even for the legendary versions of that. I'll listen to the one that's in Adventures in Babysitting, and I'll listen to it in the background of Weird Science. That's about it. I don't have any time for I'm a Man or any of those. I really dislike that genre. So for me, the whole album falls in a thing where I'm glad I heard it. And it's the same way, like you said, like I knew that this was like a Motorhead kind of thing where punks like it.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't fit a genre that you expect, punks and metalheads and like advanced listeners to be into, but they for some reason give Rose Tattoo a pass because they're sort of like an exotic choice. They're out of the ordinary, they're from half a world away, and they have some sort of clout, but I don't care about that. It's not for me. but they're great. Like, if you want to hear that, this kind of balls to the wall, like they're so good at it. They're so, the energy is great, the vocals are terrific. It's all there. Like, it's perfect. So if you want to have one album that isn't Appetite for Destruction for some reason, I don't know why you do that, but this is the other one that you would buy. So my first choice was a real, real basic man choice. I did Velvet Underground and Nico, because I've legit never listened to this album. I'm not a moron. So I know what Lou Reed sounds like. And the band, I knew in general, and I've seen enough Wes Anderson movies to know what Nico sounds like. So I kind of knew, I sort of knew what I was getting into, but I've never been able to place like the timeline of the Velvet Underground. Cause you know, when they started, I think they were just kind of this abstract droney, just whatever mess.
Yep.
And then, you know, Andy Warhol or whatever fixed them up and put them in, put Nico in the band or whatever. And they became another thing. And then after this, they became more of like a better band, I think, or whatever. This is an interesting, this is the most varied one of this episode, I think, because this goes between, you know, almost like 50s rock pastiche songs and like weird droney, you know, not meditation, but just like drone songs. And then the Nico songs, which are like sunny pop. They're like very strange sunny pop. And I like those songs because they, like, I like the band Stereolab, and they're obviously influenced by this. Like, these band sounds like the 60s version of Stereolab when they do those songs. I don't love them, but I like them. The 50s rock songs, I could take or leave. I think that that's the most direct line between Velvet Underground and punk. I think that the punk bands who were formed after this were probably just listening to like Run, Run, Run and some of those like those, you know, 50 songs that are on this. But then there's these really drony abstract songs. And they're fine. There's nothing wrong with them. But here's the problem is that I don't know what this guitarist thinks he's doing. And you're not gonna convince me otherwise. You come at me with a tank, I'm gonna stand up and tell you that I don't know what this guitarist thinks he's fucking doing. And it's all over the album. It's everywhere that the plate, it's everywhere that it wigs out, you know, everywhere that it goes crazy. Like he just starts going and it's just pointless. It's stupid. You could tell he could play. He plays all the other stuff. He plays the riffs. He plays like the little licks and the extra stuff. He plays them flawlessly. And some of it's really good. Like there's good guitar playing on this. And the one dude, John Cale or whatever, actually went to school for music. So there's pedigree in this band that whoever's doing that is trying to like, I don't know. He's just making shit up. And it literally sounds like the funny guy picked up the guitar at the party and he's making faces and just going like, he's just like, flipping the pick around and he's just flaring all over the thing and it's half the song. Any of the freak out songs, that's half the song is a guy just making up like some sort of sitar, like he's trying to do the Beatles sitar thing but failing, just falling on his face. And I think that you're supposed to be moved by that somehow. You're supposed to be like, oh man, this is so crazy, and he's exploring a guitar. You know when you're supposed to explore the guitar is at practice. You're supposed to have already explored it and been better at it by the time you got to the recording session. I think that there's a few places on this where language has moved on. Not you know what I mean? Like not in terms of like racism or something like that, but I mean like, you know, so like one of the standout songs most people know is Venus and Furs, and it's about like bondage and S&M. And like, you know, it's like lick the boots of shiny, shiny leather. And you know, you're supposed to hear that and be like, ooh, these guys are so freaky or crazy, but that kind of language is like time has left that behind. It's not intimidating or like sexy, yeah, or weird anymore. It's just kind of like, it sounds silly. It makes me think of like REM, Shiny Happy People or something like that. And, you know, there's other stuff on here that's like that, where I think that, you know, like the shocking language about heroin use or whatever, time's moved on. And some of these songs can't, like, these are only shocking if you literally bought this shirt at Target a couple weeks ago. All in all, like, I think it's cool album. This didn't fall, like, other than the thing that, like, my rant about the guitar, this album didn't really fall flat for me. I thought it was as interesting as it needed to be for something that influenced stuff I like later. The song All Tomorrow's Parties, that's a cool title. Like, it makes me think of Epcot Center or something like that. So it's like, you know, there's a festival that's actually not that far from where I live called All Tomorrow's Parties. That's like a cool, you know, curated you know, oddball rock festival. And I just always thought that that phrase sounded like, I don't think it's meant to be that way. I don't think that that's what the song is about, but it sounds like, you know, hopeful, futuristic to me, like you know, 3-2-1 contact or something like that. So that's pretty neat. But yeah, like, you know, so the drone songs are neat. Well, if you delete the bad parts, 50 songs, the good filler, and the change of pace that you get from the weird Nico songs, it's like little breath mint every couple tracks or so. So Mike, what did you think of this album?
Before I get into it, I just wanted to mention that I rewatched the A Band Called Death documentary yesterday, which is the punk, the all black punk band Death.
Yeah.
the Chuck Schuldiner death. But speaking of the dated language, I forgot that like half of that documentary is dedicated to how they couldn't get signed because their name was Death. And that's like crazy to think about, right? that was somehow the thing that allegedly, I don't know how much I believe them, but
yeah,
you know, allegedly that was what kept them from ever being on a major label, was because they refused to change their name, and Death was just too terrifying for people back then. And that's wild to think about.
Well, you know, even when I was like, I mean, I was a child, but when I was like 12, 13 years old and first getting into metal and reading, you know, Rip magazine at the time, and there would be ads for Death, Scream, Bloody Gore. And me and my friend were both just looking at that saying, Death? You just named your band Death? Like, the fuck? And we both thought that was like kind of scary, but also just hilarious. There wasn't a lot of death metal ads in Rip, so the bar was kind of low, but still.
So yeah, I guess maybe that story does hold up. Maybe that is not bullshit. So yeah, I heard Velvet Underground around probably when it started to become easy to download stuff. And I started exploring music more. And I legitimately did a lot of drugs, not like heroin drugs, but I just loved experimenting with drugs because I think everybody should do it. Because why not? Like, why not see what this weird thing does to you in your body? It's like, it's a fun thing if you're young. And so I would like, anytime I heard about druggy music, you know, like your classic druggy music outside of fucking jam band shit, because that's always sucked, but
yeah,
you know, these bands, like, I'm really into Spiritualized, and that's total like drug man music and just stuff like that.
Yep.
And you know, I heard, you know, Velvet Underground, they're known for being like Andy Warhol, blah blah blah, and heroin and all this shit, so I was like, oh, I can finally listen to this band. And I listened to it, and you know, it wasn't really for me, but it's not like I listened to it once and threw it out. I did listen to this, like, you know, for a few months or whatever. But it just, outside of like the first half of it, it's just kind of, once, like Scott said, once it gets in the freak out shit, I don't give a shit. But, you know, looking at it for this episode, I went to their Wikipedia, and it's much like Captain Beefheart, where it's something that was completely panned when it came out. Yeah. And now it's supposedly like, you know, one of the 10 records you need to hear before you die on everybody's list. And I don't know about that. I do think this is an essential record. I think this is a record people who are into music should listen to. Not so much because it's, you know, according to Wikipedia, it's influenced so many bands, blah, blah, blah. I don't really care about that aspect to it. What I think is really cool about this record is that it's very much steeped in its time and place, which is 1960s New York City.
Yeah.
And that's not a thing with how small the world is now. That's not really a thing anymore. You're not getting major music from like a time and place anymore. It's just kind of like a big gumbo of just different sounds and stuff like that. And you know, I've lived in New York, and you know, there's a lot of people that just romanticize New York, so it's cool hearing this guy talking about like going uptown to score heroin and shit like that.
Yeah.
And you know, it's cool in that aspect. And so I definitely think it has its place on all of these lists and stuff, but the freak out shit, I don't think it carries over for me in the 2000s. Basically, it's not cool anymore. So even though it's not really a record, I'm gonna like play again tomorrow or probably ever again, unless I have to talk about it again. I know people are like that though. Like my girlfriend likes this record.
Yeah.
So there are people who do listen to this as if it's their music that they listen to basically on a regular basis. That is something I will never understand, but I do think it has its place, and it's a great album for you know, just kind of like that time capsule aspect to it. Yeah. So it's a thumbs up from me, but not because I love listening to it.
Yeah, if this is your weird album, you're not doing too bad. Like this is fine. Like if you ride for this, if this is, you know, like when you put this on when you want to have a moment.
Yeah, this is actually one of those classic records. It's probably a rare classic record that we're ever going to talk about on the show that actually probably lives up to all the hype.
Yeah, totally. You can wear the shirt. You're cleared to wear the shirt.
You can wear the shirt from Target. Yeah. Okay, so my next one, or my personal pick, is Dag Nasty's Can I Say from 1986. I did not know this record was that old when I picked this.
Neither did I. Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty old. I chose this record basically because I've never listened to Dag Nasty. I have a feeling after listening to this that, you know, I probably heard it here and there, and maybe in somebody's car or something like that, but I never sat down with this record or anything like that. And I was always kind of under, like, I just kind of made up my own narrative for this band in my head that they were the band that kind of influenced the poppier, more melodic side of hardcore. Yeah. And I don't think I'm completely wrong in just having that prejudgment, but I think I was a little off. But yeah. Basically, I never listened to it. That's the end of the story of why I picked this. And yeah, I don't have, like, I didn't have a real desire to ever hear this. So it's just kind of like, I mentioned it in the last episode with Dylan. So I was just like, yeah, might as well just cross it off the list. Finally, I like how this record, so it is pretty much like a very proto version of what would become melodic hardcore. Maybe not as poppy as something like Lifetime, but it's, you know, it's something, it's more on like the softer side of hardcore, but it's definitely rooted in hardcore music, that's for sure. I like how this record kind of just starts in the middle of a song. I don't know if that was on purpose or what, but this, like, they're already into it. There's no drum click or anything. They're just like already in the middle of a song when this record starts. And that's really cool. If anybody knows if that's like on purpose or that was an actual studio fuck up, please let me know, because I'm pretty interested. The one influence that never crossed my mind is that a band I like that's very polarizing, I won't even say polarizing, I'd probably say more people hate them than love them, is Ignite. I've always loved Ignite, and I could see this guy, the singer of Dag Nasty, was probably a big influence on Ignite, because no one else sings like that. I thought the guy from Ignite made it up. I thought he made up that voice, but no, the singer of Dag Nasty, and I know they have multiple singers, so I can't remember which one this is, because I didn't do any deep digging. But he has, like, he's trying to sing basically like a choir boy sometimes, I guess you would say, where he's just trying to, like, hold out these words and just go whoa, and like he does that, and I'm into that shit, so
yeah,
I'm kind of in super into that style. For whatever reason, on this on Spotify, Circles is the third track on this. This is their most played song, and after listening to this four times, I don't get it. I don't know why this is their most played song. There must be some story behind it, but yeah, it doesn't really stick out for me. What Now is probably my favorite song on this record, but I unfortunately wrote notes this time, but did not write specific notes, and I don't remember song titles otherwise, and the only reason I could read them right now is because I wrote them down, but I did not write down why I thought What Now was the best song, but that was definitely the stick out for me. There is, of course, just like in the 80s, there's a joke song. Luckily, it's at the end of the record, so you could just turn it off after the joke song comes on. It's about, he has my dog's a cat. And it's, you know, it's a terrible throwaway song. Do you think that's ever going to come back, Scott? You think, you know, people, there's bands that sound note for note like a 90s victory band now. Do you think any kind of older or kind of like homage bands are going to just start doing a joke song again?
Well, you know, there's those bands like you found, Wrist Meets Razor and See a Space Cowboy, that are bringing back the thing nobody wanted, which is early 2000s like scene screamo. And, yeah, you know, next up is definitely like the Neon Broken Side thing or something like that. So, you know, we talked about On and Off, we've talked about you know, Turnstile and all these other bands that are kind of throwback sounding. Someone's got to resurrect Skits and Jokes, yeah, and the funk metal track with horns and whatever else. It's, well, you know, actually, you know, now that I say that, it's kind of embedded in the idea of physical media, because you're stuck with it. Nobody's stuck with anything anymore. So maybe,
that's true.
You know, you're not going to get any downloads on that track. So that might hurt your algorithm. Yeah.
No one's paying for your studio time anymore either. So it's kind of like, you can't waste somebody's money by making a joke song anymore. Right. I was curious when listening to this that his vocals are so unique, and there are What Now is actually the song that I just remembered, the one I said was the best song. There's parts on that where he actually sounds like he's out of breath, and they're recording this. They could stop and he could take a break and record that part over again. But I guess he was just so dedicated to this music that maybe he did it in one take or very little takes. And so I was like, there's no way he could probably hold this out in a live setting. And they're, unfortunately, are live songs on this record, and he does not hold out. He does not really pull off that kind of chorus, kind of choir boy style he's doing on this. It still sounds good live, but it doesn't have the same effect. This is unfortunately, I think, a record that I fucked up, basically, where I would have definitely liked this when I was 16, but now, listening to it now, I'm just like so too late on this to really appreciate it. It's For 1986, I think this is mind blowing, but so many more bands kind of surpassed them doing this style at this point, where this just seems like, you know, a proto version of music I've basically been listening to my whole life. So so it's just kind of like, I can't go back now. It's not like, you know, people still who like stoner metal can still listen to Black Sabbath, and I don't think they're the Black Sabbath of melodic hardcore or anything, where I could listen to this. I appreciate it, and I am really bummed that I just fucking skipped over it for my whole life. I think they've like had a different singer after this, and that record might have a different sound or some shit like that. So maybe I'll revisit more of their records. I think they only have one or two more. But
we gotta do Wig Out at Denko's. That's the other one that people are
okay. Yeah, so maybe there will be a part two to this, but I did enjoy this. Unfortunately, I don't think it's a thing I could just pick up and listen to now, because I'm like, I listen to it and I'm just like, there's so much better sounding shit out there at this point. But 1986 is fucking great. I'm glad I listened to it. This is a, you know, satisfied hole filled right here. But, but what did you think, Scott? Have you heard Dag Nasty before?
So this is a band for dads. if you're not a dad now, when you get your first Dag Nasty tattoo on your leg, you're going to find a child in your house. And you're going to be 38, whether you like it or not. You're gonna be a dad. I'd never heard them either. This is a hole for me as well. I know all about, you know, that they're a thing. But here's a little tangle. So I'd always confuse them with just like the Descendants or something, because I don't listen to
Don't they have the same singer or something, or maybe or something that, like that?
I just looked it up. So it's like he was in All, which is the Descendants without Milo.
Without the guy, yeah.
So there's a whole tangle there. They don't have anything sonically to do with the Descendants, but I just like, that's the kind of music that the same guy listens to. The same guy.
See, that's a valid point, though. That's a very valid point.
So, when I listen to this, every scene, I think, has a guy who is really talented and he sees what the cool people are doing, but they're not doing it as well, and he thinks he can do better. So he does a really musical and tight and accurate version of it, but you hate it because it's like, you know what I mean? Because it's like, it's got nothing below the belt. It's just, it's just like saggy, because it's like, you know, there's just no nuts to it or whatever. And you know, the reason that some people can get away with half-assed things is because they have style or spirit or, you know,
charisma,
something like they're selling it. So to me, this sounds like the music nerd heard Embrace or Ian MacKaye and was like, I could do that, but a little bit better. And he showed up and he did do it, but a little bit better, but he has no nuts at all. So, the first few tracks in this album are just kind of like a really, really white nerdy guy trying to be, you know, a DC emo guy. That's what it sounds like to me.
This is on Discord too, so that makes sense.
Yeah, and not also looking right now, Ian MacKaye produced this, so there's no bad blood about the fact that it. And apparently, the Embrace album came out the same year, so I don't know who's first, but I mean, I know that Ian MacKaye was doing stuff before this, so there had to be an influence because he's doing exactly the same bag of tricks.
Yeah,
so maybe they're friends, maybe they're kind of mutually influencing each other. I don't know, whatever. But I listen to this and I hear that. So I don't like it and I don't like it and I don't like it. And then guess what? Track four, all of a sudden this guy learns how to sing again. So we're the third album, the second album, this episode where this happens. Track five, the album, the song Justification, all of a sudden he starts doing like a shout version of it and kind of like finds his spirit, and the guitars get a little better and everything just seems to elevate. And I think from then on, you know, until the joke track, tracks five through, you know, nine or whatever, pretty good. Like this is my kind of thing. I don't know if I have room for it in my heart or brain anymore, like to take on the Embrace album is one of my favorite albums. I listen to it all the time still. And this is in the same pocket. If someone knows some weird angular reason why it doesn't fit because they were from a different neighborhood or something like that, whatever. I'm listening to it and I'm hearing, Embrace, like that style. It sounds like it to me, just a little bit more musical, a little more rock or whatever. And the fact that they're all sort of entangled and intertwined.
I vividly remember downloading and burning Embrace onto a CD.
Yeah.
But that's another, like, I don't even kind of remember what they sound like anymore. So I might revisit that on a later episode now.
Well, oddly, when you said that one song starts half like in the middle,
Yeah.
That's also an Embrace thing. Like Dance of Days is one of their hits. Dance of Days is one of their hits. And it kind of sounds like they're starting, you know, in media res, like the song's just, you're catching it in the middle or something like that.
So I might have to withhold my opinion on Dag Nasty until a future episode, because I thought these guys invented all this shit outside of the Ian McKay singing, but I thought they invented it. So now I have to hear Embrace to see maybe I've just been missing a huge hole. This is not just a tiny hole. This is a huge hole.
If the kid in my high school, like I was a metal guy, a sworn metal guy. And at the time I was hearing a lot about emo, from friends. And I was thinking more like, you know, Split Lip Chamberlain, like crying emo. And I don't know what I thought in my brain. It was probably more like Sunny Day Real Estate, which I was not going to tolerate at 16. But a friend of mine was like, no, some of it kind of rocks here. Listen to like a Fugazi and Embrace. And I was like, you know, it's not, we don't really call this stuff emo anymore, but at the time that's what was passing, and it rocks and it's like burly and stuff. So it's cool. If you had given me this CD at the exact same time, this would be one of my favorite CDs. This would be one of my favorite albums, like to this day, if I had gotten it exactly at age 17, when Davin from my high school, who was not even a hardcore dude, gave me some stuff to listen to.
Yeah. So it's your fault, Dag Nasty. You can have two fans right here.
Yeah.
I would have instantly had a kid and a tattoo, but you fucked up.
Catch up, motherfuckers. So my, I get the jewel of today's episode, and I don't think I'm going to get to talk at all. I think I'm just going to get moshed right off the fucking podcast. I decided to finally like burst the bubble and listen to Hatebreed's Satisfaction is the Death of Desire. I'm going to put a mosh part right here. Just wait for a second. Yeah, so this is Satisfaction, Death, and Desire. Is this their debut?
This is their album. Yeah, they had two demos and technically a couple 7-inches before from this.
Christian metalcore brand Hatebreed. Yeah. 1997, Victory Records. These days, I have a very wide open soft spot for more stomping. I won't call this ignorant hardcore, but I have a soft spot for ignorant hardcore, which is influenced by this. And slam metal and all the other dumb stuff that people listen to that I would have turned my nose up at when I was, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old. But at 1997, no way. I was not into tough guy music. I was not into Flames. If you have a logo with Flames and you're also tough, no chance. There's no chance. I had nothing to do with this album. I knew about Hatebreed for a long time. I got the vibe and I was like, nope. Like, so there was like Victory as a label had a lot to prove to me. And they ultimately did on a few albums, but it was an uphill battle until they put out the Dead Guy album. I don't know where this was coming from. I don't know what was kind of influencing this, but are these different recordings assembled?
No, this is these are like re-recordings. So
this was made to be an album. Like they did this all at once.
As far as I know, yeah.
First three songs are so awesome and heavy. The intro is astounding, you know, and then when he starts like singing, he's doing a really credible and good Max Cavalera impression from like the really good part of Sepultura, like the good the good era of Sepultura. He sounds exactly like him, like almost like he's even doing the accent. And if you're a Sepultura fan, you know what I'm talking about. You're doing the accent now. You're singing like Mass Hypnosis in a funny accent. But he does this really awesome, super heavy, super wide, you know, it just sounds like a bear. Like, you know, it's like it takes up a lot of space in the mix, and the guitars are super heavy and everything's really dense and the kick drums are like pummeling. And I like it. I like all of them, even the groove metal parts, because the groove, like there's some parts like, you know, they get into some of that stuff, which normally would be off limits, but it really made me feel like Headbangers Ball. It made me feel like I was a young again, like watching, you know, when they would have the prong, like the cars crashing into each other while prong riffs played, or SOD. And this doesn't sound like either of those, but it just made me feel that way. And then the song Puritan comes out and it just changes. He all of a sudden, like, he sounds like a white guy from Connecticut. He's doing the enunciation and like it's really clear.
I guess I could explain that then, because the first three tracks were written specifically for this record.
Right.
And then a lot of the next tracks were demos that were around for years and years. That was what they were touring off of for years, was Puritan, conceived from an act of violence, prepare for war, not one truth. Those are all like songs they were playing like a million times. So I guess that makes sense because that, you know, you would like the newer songs over the older stuff then.
So, you know, one of the things that was sort of mysterious to me is that not being a fan, I thought Jamie Josta was basically like almost like a motivational speaker, that was his bag is writing these, you know, the world is kicking you in the nuts, but you have to get strong and rise up and I'm here for you and I'm going to defend you from abusive parents and videos and stuff like that. I thought that was the deal, but this album, he's just bitching. He's just bitching about like pain and suffering and how... Did he change? Is this like indicative, or did they kind of change gears after this album?
Like I said, these are all old. They left off the song "Filth," which was one of my favorite songs.
Yeah.
And that song was supposedly about veganism. I don't know if that was ever true or not, but yeah, back then it was definitely like more angry, less motivational.
There definitely seems to be some shots fired in this. Like they have "Not One Truth," which I assume is aimed at Strife.
Yeah, I don't know if it's at Strife, but maybe it could be. Yeah, I don't know.
But I can't remember, but I just feel like a few, maybe even the Puritan song, I'm not sure, but there seemed like a few songs in here were specifically taking on some trends
and some subcultures. Yeah.
Yeah, so I feel like, I don't really want to say that they run out of steam, but as the album goes on, I'm kind of less, like, it just felt like more of the same for several of the last few tracks to me. I feel like future Hatebreed is going to be more my thing. One of my questions is, do you think Jamie Josta was really being like driven down by the world this hard and really needed to rise again, you know, stronger? Do you think he was really encountering this much?
Absolutely not, man. No. Yeah, Jamie was like a Freddy from Madball type of deal, where Jamie is my age and he's been going to shows probably twice as long as me somehow. So yeah. He's been in bands and been going to shows since he was like 11 years old, basically.
It seems like a certain kind of guy who probably isn't really having that hard of a time is the sort of person to do this, like, I am a wolf of, you know, like a strength and character, and I will ride, like, no matter how hard the gears of the world grind me down, it makes me sharper and harder. And like those people don't seem to have a lot going against them.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like Carl Crisis, do you really think he was forged in the flames of chaos?
No.
I mean, to me, the hammered by trials means they didn't have tofu pups at the barbecue or something like that. So
I would say, well, I mean, I know Jamie grew up in kind of a shitty area. I would assume that was probably Carl's deal too. Shitty in the way where you're just like, you're stuck, basically, one of those types of areas.
Yeah. So, you know, once it gets a little bit more clear and he sort of like, you know, talks about, you know, conceived through an act of violence is about, you know, being about how hellish and worthless your life, or not worthless, but how difficult and, you know, unrelenting your life is if you were born of rape.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true. You could probably, it's a bad start for sure, but I think you could get past it. I think you could like build a life. Yeah, I don't know. Like, so, you know, overall, like, I think this slaps, it slams, it's, you know, all the things it's meant to be. Some of the sort of groove metal influences, time has eroded, you know, and made a little difficult. But, you know, for sure, the first three tracks, I think, on this are keepers, like maximum keepers. And I'm prepared to listen to a little bit more Hatebreed. I don't know if it's anything that I really now, I don't know if I feel this way and don't want to listen to it, but if I just want to, you know, put a couple more plates on my deadlift sometime, and, you know, maybe I'll explore. So, you know, Mike, what do you think of Hatebreed?
Oh, man. So I hope you guys have your next 2 hours reserved for this talk, because I have to start from the beginning, from basically when I was born in a hospital in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Conceived through an act of violence.
I was conceived through an act of violence. No. But no, it's no secret. I come from the same area as Hatebreed. Yeah. And it's a big source of pride for me. It's the only proud thing I have about being from Connecticut, basically, because everything else is like, I've been basically disowned, or I have like one friend left there. But no, I will start even before the inception of Hatebreed, just because this is the only time I have an opportunity to tell this story. And I know Scott already loves it, but so basically, Jamie was in a band called Josta 14, who were kind of like the local band when I was getting into hardcore. When I got into hardcore, I've said this before, but I used to hang out with this kid, Jay. His older brother, Doug, was like the guy who, you know, kind of got Jay into hardcore, and then me, and blah, blah, blah. And this was before I knew Jay, but Doug had a very short-lived band that played basically one or two shows called Miasm, which was just one of those high school, like, oh, this is like a cool sounding word.
Right.
We're going to use this for our death metal band. So he was in a band called Miasm, and I did not see them live because, you know, they broke up before I even knew Doug, but they had a videotape of their one show, and it was at a place called the Rock Bar, which later became the Tune In and then closed down. And it was like some kind of death metal showcase. There was another band on it called Bad Dog Bad, because I still have the flyer, and it's just like a band just called Lizard. Like, it was just one of those types of shows. And so there was a guy, like a host, and he was like introducing all the bands. So when it was Miasm's turn, he comes up and introduces Miasm, but before he leaves the stage, he says, "Feel free to slam." It's still something to this day I think about and say in my head, where, you know, if I'm just in the shower, I just think, "Feel free to slam." And
I'm always disappointed when I drop that line and it doesn't break up the room.
Yeah, it's such a good line. So anyways, what I'm getting at is, after Jamie left Josta 14, he wanted to form this band Hatebreed, and it ended up being a couple members of Miasm. And Doug was asked to be in to try out or be in Hatebreed, and he turned it down. I don't think he was a fan of Jamie's. I think he thought he was like a silly dude, basically.
Yeah.
And because back when, you know, what's fair is fair. I think Jamie was like 14, so it makes sense. But he had like, he would do a lot of jump kicks on stage when he sang. And like, you would, like, anytime you saw a picture of Josta 14, it would just be Jamie doing a jump kick. Yeah. And it was just kind of like, I like, some people definitely found it silly, but again, he's probably 14 years old. I mean, that's cool as hell to do jump kicks back then. But anyway, so I kind of had like the inside track on this new band called Hatebreed, because Doug knew, and he told Jay and blah, blah, blah. And like, even me and Jay were like, man, Hatebreed, that sounds like the fucking hardest band ever.
Yeah.
And so I don't even remember how we ended up getting the demo, but I know we got pretty early on, and it was like, you know, it was like just fucking time stopped as soon as we heard that demo. It was we had never heard anything like that before. And it's corny to think about now, because it's like 20 some odd years later, and millions of bands have basically copied this, but
right.
Hatebreed was really the first band to basically listen to Entombed and be like, oh, we should do breakdowns like that. So it's like more like kind of a death metal style breakdown, like jun juga jun jun. Like, that's like, you know, people were like, there was Earth Crisis, Snapcase, and they were doing kind of more of whatever, like a chuggy kind of breakdown, but yep. But Hatebreed had that like real like death metal slam breakdown, and we never heard anything like that before. And it was just like instant first love. And I got to see them once at the first time I saw them was at like a place that was like a quote unquote teen center, but it was just like a converted house. So they basically played the size of a living room. And you know, it wasn't packed. And I was like the only time I saw that. Like after that, it was just, they are just selling out every single show. And the thing that the weird thing about Hatebreed, and it's kind of weird because I was living it at the time in Connecticut, but Scott was from upstate. So it's kind of weird that he had that view as them as like a tough guy band, because when they started out, their whole deal was they were like kind of like, the guy who promoted the Tune In was named Fernando. And for whatever reason, he had a falling out with Jamie, and like Hatebreed was started, and they were like, we're never going to play that fucking club. It's kind of just like if somebody, it's like, again, this is a local reference, but if some band became the biggest hardcore band on earth from Albany that never played like a Ted E. Tall show, it was kind of like that kind of deal where they're like, we refuse to play your shows, and we're never going to play a show over X amount of dollars. Because like Fernando charged $8 for a show, which was like ridiculous at the time for some reason for it to be Phil. But you know, it was $8. Even back then, that was cheap. But so they only played like $5 and $6 shows. They had that song Filth. Like I said, it was like vaguely a vegan song. So they were kind of like underground. They even did like a mini tour with Monster X. So they were kind of tough, but they were still, and you know, their shows incited a lot of fights and stuff, but they're still like, when they started out, they're still kind of like, we're like, we have these values. So I mean, that, you know, obviously ended once they signed a Victory, but basically what I'm getting at, so they had that demo, and then they had another demo called Under the Knife, which would later become a 7-inch, and that was even fucking better to us. We're just like, holy shit, this is crazy. Then, you know, fast forward, and I can't remember if they announced it at a show that they were signed to Victory, or it was something that just, like, we heard through the grapevine. I think it was at a show where they said they signed to Victory Records, and that was just like, oh my god, this is, you know, at the time, it was the biggest record label you could be signed to and be a hardcore band. So we're just like, oh man, this is crazy. We're just like anticipating this record. Satisfaction is the Death of Desire. And I won't lie, the first time I heard it, I was slightly disappointed. And it's just because the demos, or the 7-inches, whatever you want to call them, they're like real brutal. I mean, you listen to them now and they just sound like shit, because they just sound like, you know, inferior recording.
Right.
The fucking drums sound like ass. Like, it's just a horrible mess if you listen to it for the first time now. But back then, they were just so brutal. Another change that was made on this record that wasn't before this was that I don't know which guitarist they replaced, but they replaced it with this guy, Matt, who was in a band called Eventide that was like a post-hardcore band. But he's the guy who does the backup vocals on this record, and he does not sound like a tough man. and on the demos, they either had like a tougher kind of background thing, or on the one song, I think it's Puritan, they that's one song you should visit on the demo version. They do some like pitch shifted thing where they have like satanic background vocals on it.
Oh,
and
now we're talking.
So that's not on this version of Puritan, I don't think. It's just the guy Matt doing it. And yeah, he doesn't sound like a tough guy. And this is like super polished compared to their older stuff. And it's a little faster, which at the time for me equated to like not as heavy, basically. I was like, they came out with like that first demo, and I guess it was pretty quick. They came out with a couple demos in 95 and 96, and then had this record in 97. But at the time, it felt like a lifetime. So I was kind of bummed when I saw the track list and it was like 7 old songs or something and only like 4 or 5 new ones. And they're just like redone and faster and less brutal. Mm-hmm. So I was a little disappointed, but like after I got over that initial shock of them being kind of like a tighter band now and basically being a real band, I absolutely love this record, and I loved it since that very rocky period for a week. The only, like, even to this day, I'm going to just trip over myself, but I could probably defend this as being, you know, in the top 10 of hardcore albums of all time. And I know I'm a little biased, but I'm not going to say they invented, because I'm sure some nerd is going to pick out some other like death metal crossover hardcore band that outdated Hatebreed, but at least they popularized the style of music. And even after this record, they basically became a Slayer band, or like a even like a Madball band, where they're just kind of doing like the same record. Like, mm-hmm. They don't make like hardcore, they make Hatebreed music now, basically. Yeah. Like every record is a Hatebreed record, and just like every Slayer record is a Slayer record. And that's kind of what they've been living off of, because this was their one and only full length before they got signed to a major label. And there was like a 5-year gap between this record and their major label debut. So they were just touring the shit out of this record for fucking 5 years, which is crazy that they got to be like one of the biggest bands ever, basically off of 12 songs, like 12 recorded songs in their life. Because, like I said, the demo tracks are like 8 of these tracks. So it's just crazy. So even to this day, I think the only nitpick I really have about this record is I think the last 2 songs could be cut and never missed.
Yeah.
I kind of even forgot about the song Worlds Apart, and Driven by Suffering is just one of those. It's another dated language, I guess you would say, where that's just like you see that name and you just giggle a little, because it's called Driven by Suffering. And that just seems like, I don't know, it just seems like so antiquated that somebody would seriously name a song like that. But yeah, I could go on and on. I'm not gonna. I think this is one of the most perfect records ever, outside of, like I said, the last 2 tracks being able to get cut off. But I'm glad you at least appreciate it. I would say that you might not like the rest. This might be their tip. But I mean, you might like the rest of the stuff, because it's like way more produced. It's still kind of heavy, but it's just like, after this one, it just got a little too produced for me, basically.
Well, you know, like I could be wrong, but I feel like Hatebreed is kind of populist. Like, they want people to enjoy their music, almost like an oi band or something. Like, they're like a metalcore version of an oi band, where they want you to have fun at their show and mosh and not necessarily be challenged by the sound as much as like having a good time, which means that they're probably not picking odd notes or doing any of the stuff
that I look for. No.
So like the riffs are probably pretty like Sepultura-y and like Pantera-y or something like that, where it's kind of like the expected notes. But the drummer is named Jamie Pushbutton Muckenhaupt, which is a sick name. But you know, the cover of this album is something that I think is interesting, because if you just look at the background, this looks like it could have been any one of many, many emo albums. Name of the album is written in like a very fine cursive font. There's some blurry pictures of live stuff happening, and there's people like jump kicking and stuff like that. This was like this. Delete the logo. Everything about this album, this record could have been on like Jade Tree or Ebullition or something like that. But you're saying that you didn't read them as a tough guy band, even though right there is a belly tattoo. their name.
Well, no, I mean, I did cut down my monologue a little, but I guess a big part is that before Hatebreed existed in Connecticut, I would say all hardcore kind of was on that level of like Burn, maybe. Like that was like, it seemed like everybody listened to Burn and kind of made like evolved versions of Burn. And then like, once Hatebreed hit, man, that changed. Like everything got violent. There was all these violent bands. There was fights at every show. So, you know, after they got started, I thought about them as a tough guy band. But in the beginning, when they were really trying to like sell that, I don't want to call them like a crust punk thing. But they kind of did have a crossover with that kind of like Heart Attack crowd for a little while. Not forever, obviously. But, you know, there's a solid year where they were kind of interchangeable. Even their demo cover is like one of those fucking, what's a trope now, is like one of those monkey animal testing videos or photos that like Earth Crisis would use and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, through all of my pain, I'm driven by suffering to give this I'll give it a 4.
There you go. 4. 4 is good.
Oh!